I wasn't born with this kind of enthusiasm. I didn't let on to her, of course, but secretly I was praying to be left alone, to go back to my little niche and to stay there until the war breaks. All this hocus-pocus about Russia disturbed me a little. She got so excited about it, Tanya, that we finished almost a half dozen bottles of vin ordinaire. Carl was jumping about like a cockroach. He has just enough Jew in him to lose his head over an idea like Russia. Nothing would do but to marry us off, immediately. "Hitch up," he says. "You have nothing to lose." And then he pretends to run a little errand so that we can pull off a fast one. And while she wanted it all right, Tanya, still that Russia business had gotten so solidly planted in her skull that she pissed the interval away chewing my ear off, which made me somewhat grumpy and ill at ease. Anyway, we had to think about eating and getting to the office, so we piled into a taxi on the Boulevard Edgar Quinet, just a stone's throw away from the cemetery, and off we whizzed. It was just a nice hour to spin through Paris in an open cab, and the wine rolling around in our tanks made it seem even more lovely than usual. Carl was sitting opposite us on the Strapontin, his face as red as a beet. He was happy, the poor bastard, thinking what a glorious new life he would lead on the other side of Europe. And at the same time, he felt a bit wistful, too. I could see that. He didn't really want to leave Paris, any more than I did. Paris hadn't been good to him, any more than it had to me, or to anybody for that matter, but when you've suffered and endured things here, it's then that Paris takes hold of you, grabs you by the balls, you might say, like some lovesick bitch who'd rather die than let you get out of her hands. That's how it looked to him. I could see that. Rolling over the Seine, he had a big foolish grin on his face, and he looked around at the buildings and the statues as though he were seeing them in a dream. To me, it was like a dream, too. I had my hand in Tanya's bosom, and I was squeezing her titties with all my might, and I noticed the water under the bridges and the barges and Notre Dame down below, just like the postcards show it, and I was thinking drunkenly to myself, that's how one gets fucked. But I was sly about it, too, and I knew I wouldn't ever trade all this whirling about my head for Russia or heaven or anything on earth. It was a fine afternoon, I was thinking to myself, and soon we'd be pushing a feed down our bellies, and what could we order as a special treat, some good heavy wine that would drown out all this Russia business? With a woman like Tanya, full of sap and everything, they don't give a damn what happens to you once they get an idea in their heads. Let them go far enough, and they'll pull the pants off you, right in the taxi. It was grand, though, milling through the traffic, our faces all smudged with rouge, and the wine gurgling like a sewer inside us, especially when we swung into the Rue Lafitte, which is just wide enough to frame the little temple at the end of the street, and above it, the Sacré-Cœur, a kind of exotic jumble of architecture, a lucid French idea that gouges right through your drunkenness and leaves you swimming helplessly in the past, in a fluid dream that makes you wide awake and yet doesn't jar your nerves. With Tanya back on the scene, a steady job, the drunken talk about Russia, the walks home at night, and Paris in full summer, life seems to lift its head a little higher. That's why perhaps a letter such as Boris sent me seems absolutely cockeyed. Most every day I meet Tanya around 5 o'clock to have a porto with her, as she calls it. I let her take me to places I've never seen before, the swell bars around the Champs-Élysées, where the sound of jazz and baby voices crooning seems to soak right through the mahogany woodwork. Even when you go to the lavabo, these pulpy, sappy strains pursue you, come floating into the cabinet through the ventilators, and make life all soap and iridescent bubbles. And whether it's because Sylvester is away and she feels free now, or whatever it is, Tanya certainly tries to behave like an angel. "You treated me lousy just before I went away," she says to me one day. "Why did you want to act that way? I never did anything to hurt you, did I?" We were getting sentimental, what with the soft lights and that creamy mahogany music seeping through the place. It was getting near time to go to work, and we hadn't eaten yet. The stubs were lying there in front of us, 6 francs, 4.50, 7 francs, 2.50. I was counting them up mechanically and wondering, too, at the same time, if I would like it better being a bartender. Often like that, when she was talking to me, gushing about Russia, the future, love, and all that crap, I'd get to thinking about the most irrelevant things, about shining shoes, or being a lavatory attendant, particularly, I suppose, because it was so cozy in these joints that she dragged me to, and it never occurred to me that I'd be stone sober, and perhaps old and bent. No, I imagined always that the future, however modest, would be in just this sort of ambiance, with the same tunes playing through my head, and the glasses clinking, and behind every shapely ass, a trail of perfume a yard wide that would take the stink out of life, even downstairs in the lavabo. The strange thing is, it never spoiled me trotting around to the swell bars with her like that. It was hard to leave her, certainly. I used to lead her around to the porch of a church near the office, and standing there in the dark, we'd take a last embrace, she whispering to me, "Jesus, what am I going to do now?" She wanted me to quit the job so as I could make love night and day. She didn't even care about Russia anymore, just so long as we were together. But the moment I left her, my head cleared. It was another kind of music, not so croony but good just the same, which greeted my ears when I pushed through the swinging door. And another kind of perfume, not just a yard wide, but omnipresent, a sort of sweat and patchouli that seemed to come from the machines. Coming in with a skinful, as I usually did, it was like dropping suddenly to a low altitude. Generally, I made a beeline for the toilet. That braced me up, rather. It was a little cooler there, or else the sound of water running made it seem so. It was always a cold douche, the toilet. It was real. Before you got inside, you had to pass a line of Frenchmen peeling off their clothes. Ugh, but they stank, those devils. And they were well paid for it, too. But there they were, stripped down, some in long underwear, some with beards, most of them pale, skinny rats with lead in their veins. Inside the toilet, you could take an inventory of their idle thoughts. The walls were crowded with sketches and epithets, all of them jocosely obscene, easy to understand, and on the whole rather jolly and sympathetic. It must have required a ladder to reach certain spots, but I suppose it was worthwhile doing it, even looking at it from just the psychological viewpoint. Sometimes, as I stood there taking a leak, I wondered what an impression it would make on those swell dames whom I observed passing in and out of the beautiful lavatories on the Champs-Élysées. I wondered if they would carry their tails so high, if they could see what was thought of an ass here. In their world, no doubt, everything was gauze and velvet, or they made you think so with the fine scents they gave out, swishing past you. Some of them hadn't always been such fine ladies, either. Some of them swished up and down like that, just to advertise their trade. And maybe, when they were left alone with themselves, when they talked out loud in the privacy of their boudoirs, maybe some strange things fell out of their mouths, too. Because in that world, just as in every world, the greater part of what happens is just muck and filth, sordid as any garbage can, only they are lucky enough to be able to put covers over the can. As I say, that afternoon life with Tanya never had any bad effect upon me. Once in a while I'd get too much of a skinful and I'd have to stick my finger down my throat, because it's hard to read proof when you're not all there. It requires more concentration to detect a missing comma than to epitomize Nietzsche's philosophy. You can be brilliant sometimes when you're drunk, but brilliance is out of place in the proofreading department. Dates, fractions, semicolons, these are the things that count, and these are the things that are most difficult to track down when your mind is all ablaze. Now and then, I made some bad blunders, and if it weren't that I had learned how to kiss the boss's ass, I would have been fired, that's certain. I even got a letter one day from the big mogul upstairs, a guy I never even met, so high up he was, and between a few sarcastic phrases about my more than ordinary intelligence, he hinted pretty plainly that I'd better learn my place and toe the mark, or there'd be what's what to pay. Frankly, that scared the shit out of me. After that, I never used a polysyllabic word in conversation. In fact, I hardly ever opened my trap all night. I played the high-grade moron, which is what they wanted of us. Now and then, to sort of flatter the boss, I'd go up to him and ask politely what such and such a word might mean. He liked that. He was a sort of dictionary and timetable, that guy. No matter how much beer he guzzled during the break, and he made his own private breaks too, seeing as how he was running the show, you could never trip him up on a date or a definition. He was born to the job. My only regret was that I knew too much, It leaked out now and then, despite all the precautions I took. If I happened to come to work with a book under my arm, this boss of ours would notice it, and if it were a good book, it made him venomous. But I never did anything intentionally to displease him. I liked the job too well to put a noose around my neck. Just the same, it's hard to talk to a man when you have nothing in common with him. You betray yourself, even if you use only monosyllabic words. He knew goddamned well, the boss, that I didn't take the least bit of interest in his yarns, and yet, explain it how you will, it gave him pleasure to wean me away from my dreams and fill me full of dates and historical events. It was his way of taking revenge, I suppose. The result was that I developed a bit of a neurosis. As soon as I hit the air, I became extravagant. It wouldn't matter what the subject of conversation happened to be. As we started back to Montparnasse in the early morning, I'd soon turn the fire hose on it, squelch it, in order to trot out my perverted dreams. I liked best talking about those things which none of us knew anything about. I had cultivated a mild sort of insanity, echolalia, I think it's called. All the tag ends of a night's proofing danced on the tip of my tongue. Dalmatia. I had held copy on an ad for that beautiful, jeweled resort. All right, Dalmatia. You take a train, and in the morning your pores are perspiring and the grapes are bursting their skins. I could reel it off about Dalmatia, from the Grand Boulevard to Cardinal Mazarin's palace, further, if I chose to. I don't even know where it is on the map, and I don't want to know ever. But at 3 in the morning, with all that lead in your veins and your clothes saturated with sweat and patchouli and the clink of bracelets passing through the ringer and those beer yarns that I was braced for, little things like geography, costume, speech, architecture, don't mean a goddamn thing. Dalmatia belongs to a certain hour of the night when those high gongs are snuffed out and the court of the Louvre seems so wonderfully ridiculous that you feel like weeping for no reason at all, just because it's so beautifully silent, so empty, so totally unlike the front page and the guys upstairs rolling the dice. With that little piece of Dalmatia resting on my throbbing nerves like a cold knife blade, I could experience the most wonderful sensations of voyage. And the funny thing is, again, that I could travel all around the globe, but America would never enter my mind. It was even further lost than a lost continent, because with the lost continents I felt some mysterious attachment, whereas with America I felt nothing at all. Now and then, it's true, I did think of Mona, not as of a person in a definite aura of time and space, but separately, detached, as though she had blown up into a great, cloud-like form that blotted out the past. I couldn't allow myself to think about her very long. If I had, I would have jumped off the bridge. It's strange. I had become so reconciled to this life without her, and yet if I thought about her only for a minute, it was enough to pierce the bone and marrow of my contentment and shove me back again into the agonizing gutter of my wretched past. For 7 years I went about, day and night, with only one thing on my mind, her. Were there a Christian so faithful to his God as I was to her, we would all be Jesus Christ's today. Day and night I thought of her, even when I was deceiving her. And now sometimes, in the very midst of things, sometimes when I feel that I am absolutely free of it all, suddenly, in rounding a corner perhaps, there will bob up a little square, a few trees and a bench, a deserted spot where we stood and had it out, where we drove each other crazy with bitter, jealous scenes. Always some deserted spot. Like the Place de l'Estrapade, for example, or those dingy, mournful streets off the mosque, or along that open tomb of an Avenue de Breteuil, which at 10 o'clock in the evening is so silent, so dead, that it makes one think of murder or suicide, anything that might create a vestige of human drama. When I realize that she is gone, perhaps gone forever, a great void opens up, and I feel that I am falling, falling, falling into deep, black space. And this is worse than tears, deeper than regret or pain or sorrow. It is the abyss into which Satan was plunged. There is no climbing back, no ray of light, no sound of human voice or human touch of hand. How many thousand times in walking through the streets at night have I wondered if the day would ever come again when she would be at my side, All those yearning looks I bestowed on the buildings and statues, I had looked at them so hungrily, so desperately, that by now my thoughts must have become a part of the very buildings and statues. They must be saturated with my anguish. I could not help but reflect also that when we had walked side by side through these mournful, dingy streets, now so saturated with my dream and longing, she had observed nothing, felt nothing. They were like any other streets to her, a little more sordid, perhaps, and that is all. She wouldn't remember that at a certain corner I had stopped to pick up her hairpin, or that, when I bent down to tie her laces, I remarked the spot on which her foot had rested, and that it would remain there forever, even after the cathedrals had been demolished and the whole Latin civilization wiped out forever and ever. Walking down the Rue Le Monde one night, in a fit of unusual anguish and desolation, certain things were revealed to me with poignant clarity. Whether it was that I had so often walked this street in bitterness and despair, or whether it was the remembrance of a phrase which she had dropped one night as we stood at the Place Lucien Hare, I do not know. "Why don't you show me that Paris," she said, "that you have written about?" One thing I know, that at the recollection of these words, I suddenly realized the impossibility of ever revealing to her that Paris which I had gotten to know, the Paris whose arrondissements are undefined, a Paris that has never existed except by virtue of my loneliness, my hunger for her. Such a huge Paris. It would take a lifetime to explore it again. This Paris, to which I alone had the key, hardly lends itself to a tour, even with the best of intentions. It is a Paris that has to be lived, that has to be experienced each day in a thousand different forms of torture, a Paris that grows inside you like a cancer and grows, until you are eaten away by it. Stumbling down the Rue Mouffetard, with these reflections stirring in my brain, I recalled another strange item out of the past, out of that guidebook whose leaves she had asked me to turn, but which, because the covers were so heavy, I then found impossible to pry open. For no reason at all, because at the moment my thoughts were occupied with Salavin, in whose sacred precincts I was now meandering, for no reason at all, I say, there came to mind the recollection of a day when, inspired by the plaque which I passed day in and day out, I impulsively entered the Pension Orfila and asked to see the room Strindberg had occupied. Up to that time, nothing very terrible had befallen me, though I had already lost all my worldly possessions and had known what it was to walk the streets in hunger and in fear of the police. Up to then, I had not found a single friend in Paris, a circumstance which was not so much depressing as bewildering, for wherever I have roamed in this world, the easiest thing for me to discover has been a friend. But in reality, nothing very terrible had happened to me yet. One can live without friends, as one can live without love, or even without money, that supposed sine qua non. One can live in Paris, I discovered that, on just grief and anguish. A bitter nourishment, perhaps the best there is for certain people. At any rate, I had not yet come to the end of my rope. I was only flirting with disaster. I had time and sentiment enough to spare to peep into other people's lives, to dally with the dead stuff of romance, which, however morbid it may be, when it is wrapped between the covers of a book, seems deliciously remote and anonymous. As I was leaving the place, I was conscious of an ironic smile hovering over my lips, as though I were saying to myself, "Not yet, the Pension Orfila." Since then, of course, I have learned what every madman in Paris discovers sooner or later, that there are no ready-made infernos for the tormented. It seems to me I understand a little better now why she took such huge delight in reading Strindberg. I can see her looking up from her book after reading a delicious passage and with tears of laughter in her eyes saying to me, "You're just as mad as he was. You want to be punished." What a delight that must be to the sadist when she discovers her own proper masochist. When she bites herself, as it were, to test the sharpness of her teeth. In those days, when I first knew her, she was saturated with Strindberg. That wild carnival of maggots which he reveled in, that eternal duel of the sexes, that spiderish ferocity which had endeared him to the sodden oafs of the Northland, it was that which had brought us together. We came together in a dance of death, and so quickly was I sucked down into the vortex that when I came to the surface again, I could not recognize the world. When I found myself loose, the music had ceased, the carnival was over, and I had been picked clean. After leaving